Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Governor Ron DeSantis is sending a law and order message in the state less than 6 weeks before Election Day. He says he wants protesters in Florida who throw things, cause property damage, or block traffic to be charged with felonies. Now, it's all included in a package of proposals the governor unveiled this week.
There's a difference between protest and there's a difference between violence. Protest all you want, knock your socks off. But when it goes into violence, you know, that's when there has to be accountability. And so that's what we're looking to do.
The governor's proposal would allow protest organizers to be charged with racketeering if a demonstration turns violent. It would also withhold bail for someone arrested until a court appearance and hold harmless any driver who kills a protester while trying to flee a demonstration.
There's more. The governor wants to be able to withhold state funding from Florida cities. That's if any local government cuts funding to police. If the governor's proposal becomes law, protesters arrested here in Florida could face the harshest punishments in the nation. Critics say the DeSantis proposal for protests is unconstitutional and an assault on the First Amendment. We'll go to your calls on this here on the Florida Roundup in just a moment. What do you think about the proposal from the governor for more stiff penalties for protesters? Give us a call, 305-995-1800. Tweets to at Florida Roundup.
State Senator Keith Perry joins us now, Republican from the 8th District of Florida, also the chair of the Senate Criminal Justice Committee. Senator Perry, welcome to Florida Public Radio. Thanks for your time today, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Do you support the governor's ideas as proposed this week? What do you mean by that? What is at stake in your estimation?
Well, our country was founded on a republic democracy, which means that you have a right to go change laws through elections. You have the right to pressure people. You have right to do that. And when I say pressure, you have a right to pressure by you having your voice heard. But when you use intimidation, and I think that is certainly the goal of some people, certainly not all the protesters, but there are certain protesters out there that are using intimidation. And not only intimidation, but every single citizen has the right to enjoy their freedom and their time. And so,
sure.
You know, when you see these protesters blocking traffic and people can't get to work, they can't get home to their families, you're stepping over the line. That's not a peaceful protest. Now you're infringing upon the rights of other people.
So blocking traffic, in your estimation, is a violent move by a protest?
No, not a violent. Neither is stealing someone's laptop. But stealing someone's laptop is a felony,
right?
Due to the cost of the crime.
And there are laws on the books that protect against the illegal blocking of roadways, a property damage, assault, other types of crimes that the governor has mentioned in this proposal. Why do those laws need to be changed, in your estimation?
Well, because, again, I think you can look at it from a real pragmatic standpoint and just put that. If you steal someone's laptop, you're charged with a felony. You can stop hundreds or thousands of people from going about their daily business and be charged with a misdemeanor. If you just looked at it at a lost production of time or freedom, certainly you could you make the argument that this is more serious than a misdemeanor. So I think that debate is going to happen and come out. Again, you know, on the surface, if you look at everything, it makes a lot of sense. I even suggested, and I've been speaking with some people, that we need to have, I'll use a term some people use, which is safe space. Especially if you think about with the COVID now, when you have protesters getting up in the faces, literally inches away from other protesters or other people, or especially our police officers, and putting them in danger of catching a potentially deadly virus, I think that's something that should be protected, that you can certainly speak your mind, but not where you put somebody else trying to intimidate them and potentially give them a deadly disease. I think
so. Is that some kind of additional amendment maybe that you would offer to this legislation?
I would absolutely look at doing that as this thing moves forward. Certainly, I think that's worth a serious discussion.
Regarding the blockage of traffic during protests, we certainly have seen that here in South Florida, for instance, on Interstate 95 and other causeways, for instance, from the mainland over to the beach. And I know in other locations you've seen that. The governor's proposal would hold harmless a driver who happens to hit and kill a protester during such a demonstration if they're fleeing, in the governor's words, the mob. Is that part of this legislation you support?
If it was appropriate, certainly. I mean, I look at my wife, I look at my two daughters who are 20 and 23. You look at some of the films of people getting their cars attacked. I mean, would you want your 23-year-old daughter to be stuck in people breaking their windows and doing that? I mean,
the governor's proposal, though, just discusses somebody fleeing. It doesn't discuss...
Right, trying to get away from a mob.
But it doesn't discuss violence happening to their vehicle.
Well, we're going to look into that. I think those are the things that, again, you've gotten you haven't seen any bill language come out yet. I think those things will be addressed. And this is why we have elected people and why we live in a republic, so you can elect people to debate this in an environment with rules and structure and have a chance to opine and debate and then come up with what's the right solution. So it's not, you know, the governor is not going to make a law. The governor is going to put the hands of the legislature to go through the proper format to get this done.
Indeed, that is the legislative process in Florida and elsewhere in the United States. We're speaking with State Senator Keith Perry, Republican from the 8th District of Florida, also the chair of the Senate Criminal Justice Committee. Senator Perry, Governor DeSantis appeared on Fox News Tuesday night after unveiling his proposal. This is what he said.
We're in an election season. Everyone running for office in Florida in the House or Senate, they got to take a position on this now.
Yeah.
Are you for law enforcement, rule of law, or are you going to stand with the mob? I know where I stand.
Senator Perry, where do you stand the way the governor frames this, the way he framed it on Fox News?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, we don't live in a country without laws and rules, and we have to protect people. There are ways to get things done. And I'll go a step further.
But he frames it in a binary issue. You're either for law enforcement or you're for what he says stand with the mob. Is that an appropriate framing of this debate?
Yeah, if the mob is breaking the law, then we have to protect
the law that currently exists.
Well, and then if we change the law, then we're going to stand with that. And I mentioned at the very beginning, I'm in favor of making this. I think it's a much more serious offense to do things. Some of the things that are being done, again, even getting in someone's face and spreading potentially a deadly disease. This is not.
You think that's a felony, Senator?
Potentially.
Regardless, if it's in the face of a law enforcement officer or if it's in the face of a private citizen.
Would you rather have someone steal your laptop or give you COVID-19?
Again, a binary choice that I would prefer not to make. I think most people would prefer not to have to make a choice between those two circumstances, Senator.
Right. Well, but we have to look at when people don't abide by laws, what are the consequences and what is the level? Matter of fact, I've chaired criminal justice the last couple of years.
Right.
We have worked hard to make sure mandatory minimums. We raise the felony threshold. We're doing things that we think are appropriate to address. So we've gone adding felonies is the opposite direction that we've wanted to go. But that doesn't mean it's not a binary decision. Do you have felonies or not have felonies? You have
right.
to look at all the circumstances
right, sure.
and then make that decision.
Senator Perry, just a few moments left with you, I know. Process-wise, should the legislature vote on this proposal in November when it holds an organizational session?
Well, I think we see. I don't anticipate if the writing was going away. If this was a real temporary moment in time, then maybe it'd be something we could move down the line. But if you think about the consequences of the elections and people's emotions how they're running right now, you know, we can't jeopardize our number one goal. And I've said this from the day I ran for office. I think our fundamental primary goal is to protect the citizens of the state of Florida. We have to do that and protect them in every capacity we have. So if we feel that these were becoming either more violent, more disruptive, then absolutely you need to address it as soon as possible.
If there is no clear winner, for instance, in the presidential race, and that remains to be a point of legal as well as civic contention, would you support this legislation in November after the election?
I think so, yes. I mean, I would support it as soon as we can get it done. I think it's a necessary item.
Should it go through the normal committee process?
It would go through an expedited process, but okay. The same format, the same Senator, thing, filing bills, filing amendments, and debating and voting on it.
Senator Perry, we're going to leave it there. I appreciate your time today. Thank you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you.
State Senator Keith Perry joining us from the 8th District in Florida.
Let's go now to Kara Gross. She's Legislative Director and Senior Policy Counsel for the ACLU of Florida. Kara, the ACLU has condemned this proposal by the governor as undemocratic and unconstitutional. How, in your view, does the governor's move violate the Constitution?
Thank you. And thank you so much for covering this important issue. I'm glad to be here today to talk about our concerns. There is so much wrong with this proposal that it's hard to even know where to begin. First and foremost, this anti-protest proposal is an attack on our constitutional right to free speech and the right to peaceful assembly. It is a blatant attempt to silence, criminalize, and punish Floridians who are seeking to end racial injustice and systemic racism. Protesting is a fundamental right, and the right to protest and express dissent is one of America's foundational principles. It's what makes us a democratic nation and not an authoritarian regime. The governor's proposal is intended to swiftly and forcefully crack down on the right to protest. And make no mistake about it, this is designed to instill fear in would-be protesters and to silence dissent. It's un-American, it's undemocratic.
How will the ACLU oppose this? Your organization has already announced that you will challenge the governor and seek to have this struck down swiftly. What is your counter move here?
Well, we will be working with partners and the people of Florida to do everything we can to let the governor know that we can't be silenced and that he can't enact laws that are unconstitutional and intended to strip away our First Amendment rights. Contrary to the misleading and disingenuous title of this proposal, this proposal would lead to criminalization and arrest of peaceful protesters. A more apt title would be the Silencing Dissent Act.
We do need to note that the majority of protests in Florida, unlike in some other states, have been peaceful. Let me ask you, though, as a follow-up, what's your response to what we just heard from State Senator Keith Perry? In his view, blocking traffic should be more harshly punished, since that is interfering with the welfare of those who cannot go about their business. Now, there is a long tradition in this country of civil disobedience, doing things like blocking bridges and roads. And we're seeing that with the Black Lives Matter protests of today. But what's your response to Senator Perry and his view that blocking traffic is going over the line?
It's hard to even know how to respond to that. This proposal is so broad. It contains sweeping, severe criminal penalties for those who are exercising their First Amendment rights by participating in protests. It would create a felony, a third-degree felony, to block traffic. A third-degree felony is up to 5 years in prison and a $5,000 fee for blocking traffic. I mean, this is, we're talking about peaceful protests. And in the time of COVID right now, some of the most socially distant, safe ways to protest are through car caravans. And that's why we're seeing more of that now, because that is a socially distant way to express your First Amendment rights. They don't like that, and they don't want to hear from people, and they don't want to be inconvenienced by traffic. And so they are trying to silence dissent and to lock everybody away who disagrees with them. And that's what this is about.
Lots of calls here on the Florida Roundup reacting to the governor's proposal to charge protesters in the state with felonies if demonstrations become violent or disorderly in any way. Warren is on the line. Warren, what part of the state are you from? Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. We have Pratt in West Palm Beach. Pratt, go ahead.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, it's really not surprising, the governor's proposal, the senator's words. You know, the legislative process, as much as the police have been used, you know, for years, for hundreds of years, to push racist policies and practices. You know, guess what? We call that systemic racism, right? So, you know, even if we look at history, you know, just one occasion, if I could mention, you know, where this type of irrational, unreasonable lawmaking, you know, took place is, you know, when we consider how, you know, when white women were beating black babies to death because they realized that they were products of their white husbands raping black women, we created laws to protect them, right, that allow for this to happen without prosecuting them. In the same way that this governor is saying that if someone decides to run their car through a group of protesters who are fighting for their racial justice, fighting for us to be treated like human beings, we're going to not prosecute them. It's not surprising that DeSantis would propose this type of law, because DeSantis is following a tradition of systemic racism, of policymakers using the system to make laws to benefit themselves at, you know, at the cost of black people getting equal justice and peace in this country.
Thank you,
not
Pratt.
Not surprising at all.
Thank you. These protests are about systemic racism. We do need to know that. Kara, I think the most controversial part of the governor's proposal is holding a driver harmless who might run someone down with their vehicle if they're trying to get away from an unruly protest. That has gotten, I think, the most attention around this whole matter. What about that piece of it?
It's unconscionable. It would allow counter-protesters who recklessly drive into protests to injure or kill individuals and escape liability. It's basically a license to kill for vigilantes. This provision shielding drivers if they kill or injure people by driving into them would absolutely lead to more violence against peaceful protesters and embolden white nationalists and racists.
We are continuing to get your calls and tweets here on the Florida Roundup as we talk about Governor DeSantis' proposed anti-protest bill. What do you think about this? What are your thoughts? If you're just learning about it, keep listening, because we're going to continue the conversation in a few minutes with a prosecutor who will talk about how he might prosecute such cases. In the meantime, thank you, Kara Gross, Legislative Director and Senior Policy Counsel for the ACLU of Florida. We appreciate you being with us.
Thank you so much.
That conversation continues after the break. If you're just tuning in, this is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Get on the line, share your views. It's 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. Also ahead, a judge from Florida may soon be President Trump's pick for the Supreme Court. A closer look next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We're talking about Governor Ron DeSantis' proposal released this week that would increase penalties to felonies for protesters committing violence and hold responsible protest organizers if demonstrations turn violent. It would also not charge a driver who kills a protester while fleeing a demonstration. So let's get a prosecutor's view of this proposal. Andrew Warren is with us now, the Hillsborough State Attorney. Andrew, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
What impact would this proposal have on the prosecution of protesters who commit violence, property violence, or assault?
Well, it depends on the prosecutor. Expanding and increasing penalties for crimes doesn't necessarily change the way that prosecutors prosecute. If you have prosecutors who act as rubber stamps, who simply seek the maximum punishment on every single charge they file, then it's going to have an impact. But good prosecutors aren't simply rubber stamps. They actually think through whether they're going to file charges even after an arrest has been made. They think about what the best outcome is for the public in terms of public safety and reducing recidivism and supporting victims. So the extent to which this has on prosecutors, if this package of proposals becomes law, really does depend on how good the prosecutor is.
Turns out we got a prosecutor on the phone right now, Andrew. How would you determine whether or not to pursue charges under this proposal?
Well, let's take a step back for a minute. I mean, if the goal of the proposal is to hold people accountable who commit crimes while protecting people's First Amendment rights, then that's a goal that I share. But a lot of these proposals simply increase the maximum punishment, which is a pretty lazy and ineffective way to address criminal behavior. And we got to keep in mind, overall, this looks like political theater. The proposals came from the governor, but make no mistake, this is a Trump proposal designed to divide us, distract us from racial injustice, and punish those who disagree with him. And it's important that Floridians ignore the dog whistle here and don't get fooled. I mean, here in Hillsborough County, we're doing the really hard work of protecting First Amendment rights and keeping the community safe. We filed 260 charges against more than 120 people who have been rioting, looting, exploiting this moment for personal gain and threatening public safety while still upholding people's First Amendment rights.
Were any of those charges felonies?
Yes, many of them were felonies. When people are using the cover of protests to burn down stores, rob, attack law enforcement, those are crimes that we all want to see punished because that's something that threatens safety and distracts from the message of racial injustice that the protests stand for.
You called increasing these punishments lazy and ineffective. Why aren't stiffer penalties, stiffer, higher threshold crimes a deterrent? Higher threshold penalties a deterrent?
Because to address the underlying problem, we don't need stiffer penalties. We actually need to address the underlying issues, the inequities we all know that exist in the system, police accountability, de-escalation training. And let's take it out of the context of a protest for a moment. Floridians and law enforcement across the state have been working hard to fight human trafficking with a multifaceted approach, raising awareness, changing the way we investigate cases, supporting victims. That's how we address the problem. Simply saying, oh, we're going to increase the penalty for human trafficking to double it, that's, again, a pretty lazy and ineffective way to deal with a very nuanced criminal justice problem.
Lots of tweets coming into the Florida Roundup on this hot topic as the governor proposes tougher penalties for protesters around the state. Bob tweets the show, the governor's new law sounds okay on the surface, but it also sounds like a way to suppress protests. We need to note it's not law yet. It is just a proposal at this point.
Right.
Milo in West Palm Beach. Go ahead, Milo.
Hi.
Hey.
I've actually, what was that?
Yeah, go ahead, Milo.
Hello?
You're on the air.
I've been involved in organizing some events in West Palm Beach and Palm Beach County surrounding the Black Lives Matter events this summer. And so, like, I would be held liable under this legislation if somebody at an event I held became violent.
Right.
So I think that this legislation would actually cause these events to be more violent because an organized protest with goals and with direction, there's not violence that occurs there. What happens is when the protest disperses, people linger and there's confusion, and that's when violence occurs.
All right, Milo, thanks. Andrew Warren, our prosecutor on the line, what about the racketeering piece of this proposal? As the caller pointed out, it could potentially sweep up a whole group of people who could be charged collectively in the wake of a demonstration.
Not just in a demonstration. Let's imagine a situation where the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are playing the Miami Dolphins in a football game. You have more than seven people there, and somebody walks out of the stadium, and they're upset about the outcome of the game, and they break a car window. You're telling me the other 50,000 people at the stadium have now committed a crime? Is that the organizers of that football game have committed a crime? Is that somebody who is driving away from the stadium and wants to flee an angry mob when there's no real threat to their safety can just run over people? I mean, we have to think about the law, not just in the very narrow context in which, again, this political theater has been presented to us, but how does it actually impact people's First Amendment rights? Are we criminalizing conduct that people engage in every day in this community across this state that we don't want to make criminal? And the answer is yes, because, again, it's kind of a sloppy proposal.
And it is just a proposal at this point. The proposed legislation hasn't even been written. It's essentially a bullet point presentation that folks have been responding to. Jay in Boca Raton is up next. Jay, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I have to say, you know, in agreement with many of the other callers, this is a really sneaky maneuver because on the surface, you know, I never agree with proposals like this. And now I remember why, because on the surface, it seems sort of comforting, right? It's going to de-escalate violence in theory. It's going to hold people accountable when, in fact, it's so sloppy. It's opening the door by letting one potentially good thing in theory. It's opening the door for so many other details and, you know, to the point of getting to the root cause of violence, to the root cause of these things. It's basically just going to criminalize a whole bunch of activity which shouldn't be, and then decriminalize, you know, the hold harmless clause, which is totally ridiculous, because the threat of violence is obviously a very subjective, perceived moment in time. So on the surface, seems like a good idea, right? But when you pick it apart, it just shows the necessity for constant vigilance on everyone's part, but particularly the people who do want to, you know, retain the right to peaceful assembly. And I can't remember who spoke about it, but yeah, a thoughtful, vigilant, and really circumspect prosecutor is going to pick this apart and criminalize the acts that need to be, and that's their job. So this kind of sweeping law, if it's enacted, is just going to be a disaster, and it's gonna cause a lot more problems than it solves.
Thanks for adding your voice here from Boca Raton. Andrew Warren, the Hillsborough State Attorney, how will you be using the pulpit you have as the SAO in a large populated county as this proposal gets put into legislative form and perhaps goes through the legislative process?
We'll make clear that we already have a lot of tools in our toolkit to address crimes when peaceful protests devolve into violence and unrest. We don't need new laws. What we need are leaders who are willing to listen, to engage, to listen some more, and then provide thoughtful solutions to address the problems in our communities that are the source of these protests. Again, in Hillsborough, we have been able to strike that balance of supporting people's First Amendment rights while holding people accountable and filing charges and prosecuting those who are actually committing crimes that threaten public safety. And so we don't need new laws to do this. These are scare tactics. What we want is just to make sure that we're addressing the underlying problems while making sure that we are protecting people's First Amendment rights while upholding public safety.
Andrew, we appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for walking through your ideas here. Andrew Warren, the Hillsborough State Attorney, with us here on Florida Public Radio. Lawmakers are squabbling, setting up sides, certainly over the U.S. Supreme Court and the replacement of the Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Her replacement could come before or after the 2020 election, and all eyes are on President Donald Trump's short list of jurists. He's due to announce his selection on Saturday from the White House. One of those on the shortlist, Melissa, is from Florida.
That's right. It's Barbara Lagoa, a conservative Cuban-American federal appellate judge from South Florida, and she is the first Latina to serve on the Florida Supreme Court. Now, here's Lagoa back in 2019 when she was nominated to that bench.
The Florida Supreme Court is tasked with the protection of the people's liberties under law. And in that regard, I am particularly mindful of the fact that under our constitutional system, it is for the legislature and not the courts to make the law. It is the role of judges to apply, not to alter, the work of the people's representatives.
Now, if she's chosen by Trump later this week and confirmed by the Senate, Lagoa, 52, would become the second Latina to ever serve on the nation's highest court. James Ramoser is the editor at SCOTUS Blog and is closely following all this, and he joins us now. Hi, James.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Good to have your insights here on the Florida Roundup this Friday, so close to the selection. Now, Judge Lagoa is seen as a finalist for the High Court, along with another woman, Judge Amy Coney Barrett. She's a federal appellate judge and a professor at Notre Dame. We keep hearing Barrett is the favorite, but what are Lagoa's chances, do you think?
I think Barbara Lagoa still has a real shot at earning this nomination, which President Trump is expected to announce tomorrow. The sort of betting line on who is the favorite has vacillated a little bit this week. Initially, right after the death of Justice Ginsburg, it was expected that Amy Barrett was the clear front runner. Then there was some thinking that Judge Lagoa actually had a chance. And in the last day or so, the conventional wisdom has shifted back toward Amy Coney Barrett. But I really wouldn't try to read the tea leaves too much here, because 2020 has been full of surprises, and President Trump certainly likes surprises. So I think he could easily choose either of these two candidates.
We'll have to wait and see. Following your blog is almost like waiting for the white smoke to come up from the Vatican for Supreme Court watchers. So tell us a little bit about Judge Lagoa's record as you've been studying it, and how you think she'd apply that to Supreme Court decisions.
Yeah, so it's interesting because her two most prominent positions, first as a justice of the Florida Supreme Court and then as a federal appellate judge on the 11th Circuit, she's held both of those positions for quite a short time frame. She's been basically less than a year in each of those positions. She was only appointed to the 11th Circuit late last year by President Trump. So she doesn't have much of a paper trail of opinions in those roles. In general, I would describe her record as conservative. Her most prominent position that she's taken was very recently in the controversial case in Florida over the restoration of voting rights to people with felony convictions. And Judge Lagoa joined a 6-judge majority on the 11th Circuit, holding that the Florida legislature's law requiring people with felony convictions to pay all court fines before having their voting rights restored is legal.
Right. Well, we're going to be discussing that in a few more minutes here on the show. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. So Judge Lagoa did rule on that controversial matter here in Florida. On the Florida Supreme Court, she also sided with the majority in throwing out Miami Beach's effort to raise the minimum wage. But as we heard her say a few minutes ago, she doesn't believe judges should legislate from the bench. So how does that square with her rulings, do you think?
Well, I think the concept of legislating from the bench is always in the eye of the beholder. I think all judges, whether liberal or conservative, would say that they don't legislate from the bench, but that's a very ambiguous term. And I think that depending on your views on the law and your views on policy, when one jurist claims to be neutrally applying the law as required by the Constitution, another could easily say that, could easily characterize that as judicial activism.
Yeah. Now let's talk about the swing state politics behind this. If the president picks Barbara Lagoa, she is Cuban American. She is from Florida. The Cuban American vote is a constituency that typically does support Republicans and is supporting this president. Presidents do make political calculations often when they choose a Supreme Court justice. How do you see this through a political lens if he does choose Barbara Lagoa rather than Amy Coney Barrett?
Yeah, I think the political calculation that you described is one of the primary things working in Barbara Lagoa's favor. Trump was just asked about this earlier this week, about whether there would be a political calculation in his choice of who to nominate. And I think he said that politics would basically be an inevitable part of the decision. As you say, there are demographic reasons and political reasons why she might be an attractive choice for him.
Right. So she could be the pick. But as you said, he will make the announcement tomorrow. And if he chooses Judge Barrett, she is also a conservative female judge, even more conservative, I think, by reading your blog than Judge Lagoa. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think that Amy Coney Barrett has a little bit more of a paper trail on some of the more hot button or polarizing issues. And she's certainly viewed in certain respects as more conservative. But I think it's a little premature to necessarily draw that conclusion definitively.
You have to parse judges' rulings over time, which is what you're so good at SCOTUS blog. That's a big part of what you do. What will the next 24 hours be like for you and your staff as this big announcement comes out?
Well, as you can imagine, we're quite busy.
Yeah.
We're of course fully covering and re-examining the legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and we've been spending a lot of time and resources over the last week doing that. We're of course preparing for the announcement of a new nominee, which we do expect to occur tomorrow. And then in the coming days, once the nominee is announced, we'll be looking very closely at that nominee's jurisprudence and explaining what the nomination process is going to
would,
be like.
Would be like. Forward. And thank you so much, James Ramoser, editor at SCOTUS blog. Thanks so much for being with us.
Appreciate it.
When we come back, felony fines. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Keep those calls coming to the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800, and tweets to @FloridaRoundup, a lively discussion happening on Twitter, and we are following it. Thanks for your tweets.
Been talking a lot about the law here in Florida, certainly, with Governor Ron DeSantis' proposal to increase the punishments and penalties for protesters who commit violence during demonstrations, among other ideas, talking about the possibility of a Floridian being nominated for the United States Supreme Court, and now talking about voting. Billionaire and former presidential candidate Mike Bloomberg is spending millions of dollars to help people in Florida with a felony conviction to cast a ballot in November. It's all part of a national effort to help felons in Florida pay fines and fees tied to their sentences. In 2018, the state's voters approved Amendment 4, restoring voting rights to nearly 1 million felons in the state.
But then the legislature passed a law requiring former felons to pay outstanding fines and fees before they could cast a ballot. And here's the latest in all of this. State officials now say they're going to investigate Mike Bloomberg's move to pay off felon debt. Let's get more on this from Danny Rivero of WLRN. He's been covering this story. And Neil Voltz of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Hi, guys. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, Tom.
Neil, let's start with you. State officials say they are going to actually investigate Mike Bloomberg's move to donate to your cause. What's your reaction to that?
Well, our reaction is that we're going to stay squarely focused on the real lives of real people impacted by these issues. Specifically, as somebody myself who is a person with a past felony conviction, we know that a couple months ago there were hundreds of thousands of returning citizens, what we call ourselves. And those folks went to bed at night thinking they could vote. And then a couple weeks ago, they found out that they couldn't. And what we've seen is this amazing groundswell of support behind those individuals. And our focus, our North Star, is squarely on the real lives of returning citizens who have barriers to the community, including the ability to vote. And we've seen 66,000 people donate to our fines and fees fund in recent weeks. And we've been able to pay off fines and fees for thousands of returning citizens. And each one of those is an individual person who had a barrier in place and we were able to remove that barrier. So our focus is squarely on people and on expanding democracy.
Well, Danny Rivero, you've been covering this issue. Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody says she's going to investigate whether Mike Bloomberg can support this effort to pay off fines and fees. What does the law say about how Florida residents with a prior felony conviction can accept donations to pay off what they owe?
Right. So the law that was cited in the letter that Ashley Moody sent to the FBI and to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement was really about bribery for an election itself. Like, can you give money to induce someone to vote in a particular way or just to get a large group of people out to vote? Now, I actually talked to one of the attorneys that worked on the federal case. Who has somewhat of a legal analysis of this. I think you guys have that. You could play it. This is Danielle Lang from the Campaign Legal Center who helped with
that. FRC's number one priority is ensuring that every one of the 1.4 million returning citizens have an opportunity to vote. When we were campaigning, we explicitly said that we're fighting just as hard for that person who wished he could have voted for Donald Trump as we are for that person who wished that they could have voted for Barack Obama.
We should point out that's Desmond Mead, actually, with the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, denying that the fund targets any specific people with felony convictions.
Right. And I'll fill it out because we didn't hear from Danielle, which is fine. But basically, the illegal analysis is that what people like Mike Bloomberg and tens of thousands of other people that have contributed to this fund to do is to help people become eligible to vote. And eligibility is not the same thing as registering to vote or inducing someone to vote. It's simply the eligibility for being able to do that. And I will note that the state of Florida's position through this whole thing has been distinctly that these are two different things. Becoming eligible to vote is one thing, and you know, money can be a condition for that, according to the state's position, and actually casting a vote is a separate thing. And then now at this point, it appears that the state is kind of conflating the two and saying eligibility and actually casting a vote are essentially the same thing. So it really complicates it.
The Attorney General requesting an investigation into the donation. To Neil Volz, has your organization, the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, received this money from Mike Bloomberg?
We have not yet. But what I can tell you is that we have gotten an incredible amount of support from people all across the country, all across the state, to do exactly what we were just talking about, which is to tear down a barrier that people face to have their eligibility restored.
Neil, let me just ask you have not received the money from Mr. Bloomberg. Are you aware of any conversation with Mike Bloomberg or his organization about restrictions on the donation should it ultimately wind up in the bank account of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition?
I don't know. And, you know, we keep trying to take this whole conversation out of the partisan politics that I understand happens around elections. But if you look at it from our perspective, right, we started our fines and fees fund in 2019. And we've been paying people's fines and fees in almost all of the counties in the state of Florida since that time period. And we're going to continue to do that way beyond the election. For us, this is about human beings. This is about people who we've been fighting for since before Amendment 4, when Amendment 4 passed. And there are millions of people in our state who are precluded from things like jobs and housing and the ability to be full citizens. And one of those things is the ability to vote. So yes, we have been actively working to tear down that barrier so people can become eligible to vote.
And this is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Neil Volz, Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, you said you set up this group last year to help people like yourself, people with a prior felony conviction, regain their voting rights. This is nearly a million people in Florida. And the fight over the franchise for this group has just been extraordinary to watch, because it could make a difference in the outcome of the election in this swing state. Do we know how many people of this large group have been able to successfully pay fines and fees and register to vote in the November election? Is your group keeping a tally of that?
Well, I can tell you that we recently announced a couple of days ago that we had spent over $5 million, and that would restore the eligibility for about 5,000 returning citizens. You know, and so what we've seen is that the way the process works is that people sign up for the fines and fees program, and they talk with, you know, our teams, and then we will cut a check to the clerk of courts. So we have long-standing relationships with the clerks all across the state, and that process is all set up to tear down these barriers.
Wow.
And clear somebody. They can become eligible if they choose to.
So you've spent millions to restore rights for 5,000 people. There's been a lot of criticism of the fines and fee structure for criminal justice in Florida. Often people can't even find out what they owe, and sometimes they owe a large amount for a relatively minor offense. Going past this fight, do you believe the entire system needs overhaul, as critics have been saying for a while?
Well, I mean, when we look at the real lives of people, which is our North Star, we don't waver from the real impact on returning citizens policies have. You look at the impact it has on somebody's ability to get a job if you can't pay your fines and fees, the ability to engage in democracy. There are a lot of barriers created by the system that we have. And ironically, it's then funded actually by the people who interact with the criminal justice system. So we definitely think there's a better way to do and fund our criminal justice system. And if I might add, our courts currently have been losing tens of millions of dollars because of COVID. This process that not only expands democracy, helps move people's lives forward, it's also giving much needed income into our court system.
Neil, there was a development this week with your own right to vote, correct?
Well, I had my right to vote restored by Amendment 4, and I registered in January of 2019, and I actually voted for the first time in a long time last August. But I did have my civil rights restored through the clemency process earlier this week, and I think that might be what you're talking about.
That is exactly what I'm talking about. Tell us just in our final 30 seconds here, what that meant to you.
It meant a lot. Like, I think it's important how we see each other, how we see ourselves, and it allowed me some restoration in terms of my spot in the community, how I see my voice and how I can use it. And so I was really grateful for that process, even though there's a much bigger story about that as it relates to Desmond and some of the other things that happened.
Desmond Mead, right, the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition leader, who was turned down for his petition. Neil Volz, we have to leave it there with the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Thanks again for joining us, Danny Rivero of WLRN. Just a quick update here, Danny. What's the state of this request for an investigation into the potential Mike Bloomberg donation?
Right. Well, as of this moment, I mean, we have the letter from the state attorney general asking the FBI and FDLE to look into it. I haven't confirmed that an investigation is indeed ongoing or that any kind of grand jury has been called by the state to look into it, but the request is out there.
All right. Danny Rivero, reporter at WLRN in Miami. Thanks, Danny.
And that's our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Denise Royal and Heather Schatz are the producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. The Director of Radio Operations and the program's Technical Director is Peter Mertz. We get engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones, and our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll be back next Friday at noon.